The MMQB podcast is brought to you by T-Mobile. This baseball season, T-Mobile customers can get a free season-long subscription to MLB.TV Premium. Sign up by April 10th at T-Mobile.com/MLB or sign up for MLB.TV while on T-Mobile's network. We're also brought to you by Harry's Razors. Superior razors ship straight to your door at half the drugstore price. Get $5 off your first order with the code THEMMQB at harrys.com. And by FanDuel. Now that baseball is back, you can try the fun and competition of daily fantasy risk-free for up to 10 bucks. Go to FanDuel.com and enter the code THEMMQB. Hello. Welcome to the MMQB podcast. He is Andy Benoit. And I am Gary Gramling. Glad you could join us again. A lot of things happening right now, Andy. We have, of course, Easter is more than 10 days over. And if you ask any legal scholar, they will tell you this. You now have the rights to your kids' candy if they did not eat.
Okay. Very good. That's important to you, I know. I don't have kids, but it's important to you.
It is. I've subsided off of Cadbury eggs and Reese's Pieces and coconut jelly beans for the last couple of days here.
I still have Easter decorations up because I feel like they're springtime. They're too charming to take down. But I also feel it feels stale around my house now because of it too.
Oh, you put Easter decorations up?
I do. I'm a big fan of holidays during football season. Mm-hmm. I kind of always incorporated it with football somehow growing up. During this time of year, spring, late winter, Valentine's, St. Patrick's, Easter, I'm not big into it, but I do have the decorations because I'm a big fan of decorating.
Oh, that's really nice.
I'm a seasonal individual.
I was going to say, everyone decorates holiday time, whether your holiday is Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever else you might celebrate. That's really cool, though. That's a year-round thing. You're sort of a hardcore decorator then.
Yeah, I am. It's true, yeah.
And the other thing going on here in the office today, all the TVs have golf on, which, you know, it's always like they're all on mute, and you usually just get like the talking heads. Like you look up and see, you know, it's on whatever ESPN and Adam Schefter is on there, or you get NFL Network and they got Eisen up there or whatever. But it's golf, kind of around the office right now, which is strange to see because obviously the Masters is going on. But are you a golf guy?
I used to be, but anymore, if I could play it at night, I would really enjoy it. But I don't have the kind of free time during the day to play it. And around age 20, I realized I'm paying a lot of money here to just get really mad at myself, just to get overwhelmed with frustration. Because it felt like the better I got at golf, the more I would suck in my mind. So I stopped golfing because of that.
That's terrifying. I mean, I would like to play
at
night just because I really don't. I have like my pros and cons list of why to do it or why not to do it. And, you know, pros are sitting on a golf cart and drinking, and the cons are playing the actual golf, which I'm terrible at, and also just being out in the hot, punishing sun. My pasty complexion just doesn't hold up to it.
I gotcha.
All right, we'll move on to, we'll save that for the golf podcast if they ever let us on, which they will not. But we'll move on to football here. And I wanted to start with a quick one here. Ian Rappaport reported the competition committee endorsed expanded playoffs. Now, it's kind of shocking that hasn't happened before because more games is more money. And the only thing driving ownership in the NFL seems to be more money. Do you like the thought of expanding from, what would it be, 12 teams to 14, I think they're saying? So you'd have one bye?
Yeah, I hate it. I hate the thought of that. Any kind of playoff dilution to me at this point is awful. I think six is the right amount. I've talked to a lot of coaches around the league about this because they all have strong opinions on it. And mm-hmm. one of the overarching opinions is that if there's only one bye week, that bye week becomes too valuable and too unfair. That the one seed's important, it's nice, but it's not that much greater of an accomplishment than the two seed to warrant being the only bye week team. Mm-hmm. So that's one concern. The other concern is these regular season games in the NFL matter. They mean something. And that is why NFL grows. And it's the only sport where that's true. Now, maybe college football to a certain degree, but college football, there's only about 12 teams truly in contention for a title during the regular season at any point. And so most of the games really don't matter in the grander scheme of things. In the NFL, that's almost never the case. So yeah. I think if they do expand the playoffs, which is inevitable, they need to do something to make the regular season games matter more, or they need to do something to make home field advantage in the playoffs matter more. Because if teams have seven spots available, that more teams get in. So now how do we convince those teams to keep playing? How do we make it interesting when a team's a 3 and a 4 seed? And I think the way to do it is if you add significance to home field advantage, then seeding becomes more important, and that can offset the playoff watering down. And to me, the only way you can add significance to home field advantage is if you adjust overtime rules and give the home team the ball first possession in overtime every single time.
See, I would like to see him roll it back, which would obviously never happen because no one ever listens to me. But just send the four division winners in each league. And those are your playoff teams. Nice, even 18
really?
Playoff. Yeah.
Boy, that's a little extreme.
Well, listen, you have unbalanced schedules already. So you can
design. That's by design.
Exactly. So why not just send the four division winners? If you win your division, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, wild card is the first loser. And I'm going to put that on a t-shirt and make millions with it. But if you can't win your division, why do you get the chance to play for a championship? It doesn't logically
not
add
all
up.
Divisions are created equal, though.
Well,
I
that's fine.
I think the unbalanced schedule thing that you bring up is the argument for wild card, because look at like the NFC West back in 2010, I think it was, the NFC South back in 2014, when those teams were barely 500, actually a tad below 500, I think. So under your rules, one of those teams would get in as they do now, but a team that went, if someone's 7-9 winning the division, it means someone else is probably 12-4 mm-hmm. finishing second in the division elsewhere. So you're saying the 7-9 team gets in, but the 12-4 team wouldn't.
That's fine. 12-4 team should have won their division.
Oh boy. That's awfully regionalized. I
think that's fine.
I don't like the idea, but I'm trying to decide if I like it more or less than adding a seventh wild card, you know, a seventh playoff spot, a third wild card.
That's you like it more. When you as you lay your head
know,
down
Gary,
to sleep tonight
I don't know
and
if I
think
can get
about
on board
it.
With that.
That's
really either right. I don't know if it's right winged or left wing. It's hard to one side or the other. Whatever position that is, that's
it's
an
not in the middle.
Position.
It's not in the middle. Whatever it is, I just think if you're gonna recognize division winners, how can you not win your division and win the Super Bowl? It doesn't make sense. Logically, it doesn't make sense. I know they'd never do that, but logically, it doesn't add up.
What do you think of my idea of making overtime the automatic possession for the home team, so that way home games and earning home games in the playoffs becomes more crucial?
I'm fine with that. I think that's good outside the box thinking.
I would also do. Remember the Le'Veon Bell play in the Monday night game against San Diego in Week 5, where they went for it with one play left in the game. They could have kicked the tying field goal and they went for the winning touchdown. I think we'll see more buzzer beater plays like that, because I think road teams would be incentivized to play for the game winning plays rather than playing for overtime too.
I'd go for that. I mean, look, not a ton of games go to overtime. I think you and I can maybe sneak that through next time the owners get together.
Yeah, well, and also send a note to Adam Dorsett, the magazine, for me, because I wrote a whole 900-word thing on this last year, and he turned it down twice, which is the only time I've ever been turned down after writing the article for the magazine.
Oh, that is cold.
Well,
no, I don't mind that idea.
You know, I've been turned down a lot before the articles, but I wrote it. He didn't like the first one. I rewrote it, and then the whole idea went by the wayside.
On that concept, on the new overtime rules.
Yeah.
See, I'm fine with that. I think overtime, once you get to overtime, the game's a coin flip anyway.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, if two teams play 60 minutes and are that evenly matched, yeah, just turn it's decide it however you want to decide it. That's what I say.
Yeah, that's one, your point about 60 minutes, that's why I don't mind ties so much. I know they're a pain in the butt to deal with and how the standings look in playoff scenarios. Mm-hmm. But if wins and losses, the whole idea of those are to reflect how a game went and who played better than the other team, essentially, then if they played so evenly that they were tied after 60 minutes, I think a tie is the most fair, the fairest way to present the outcome of the game. But we've really digressed here. I don't know how you feel about ties now. And I certainly don't like ties in the playoffs, which I know would never happen.
We have. We're already like 48 minutes into the podcast here. So let's move on to some of the stuff, I don't know, more based in reality than what we just discussed. I want to start with NJ Advanced Media had a piece about Jason Pierre-Paul, new D-line coach there, Jeff Skinnina, which I had no idea it was pronounced that way until I just looked it up, said he was shocked how well Pierre-Paul played last year. He made a lot of plays and was still really disruptive with that big club on his hand. The sky's the limit now. Now, obviously, anyone looking at Pierre-Paul's stat line from a year ago, you see one sack, and people know, or people should know, not to judge a pass rusher's production solely based on the sack statistic. And if you don't know that, you are just un-American. What did you see from Pierre-Paul last year? Because when I watched him and I saw all these near misses, I couldn't get out of my head, you know, ooh, it, you know, if his hand was fully healthy, he would have gotten that sack. And I don't know if that's realistic or not.
No, there were cases where that was clearly apparent on film, that he could have had more sacks, that he was having to adjust to the club. And talking with people who were with the Giants last year, Jeff Skinnina, I know, just joined them, but the people who had Pierre-Paul last year, they felt he wasn't the same player and that they're really eager to see what he'll do this year now that he's had his hands healed, not healed, but it's he's had an adjustment. I think he's got a new, not a club, but he's going to play without a club this year.
Yeah, he said he wouldn't play.
And they're eager to see. So they moved him from right DN to left DN to try to compensate for the hand. So he also had an adjustment to make about where he was lining up. This is a big make or break year for Pierre-Paul. We're going to learn a lot about him. And the Giants told you that they feel that way by giving him only a 1 year contract.
Yep. Yep. It's, I just think the whole Giants situation is fascinating. Pierre-Paul, what's he going to be? Olivier Vernon, is he for real or not? And, I don't love the Janoris Jenkins signing from I think they got a great player and a great deal. I mean, obviously they overpaid for Janoris Jenkins, and that's fine. That's what you do in free agency these days. But I just love it from the standpoint of, to me, they're just saying, our pass rushers are going to get there this year. They didn't last year. The guys we have, the new guys we have coming in, and a healthy Pierre-Paul are going to get it done. Because if they don't, Janoris Jenkins is a potentially huge liability as this, you know, constantly gambling cover cornerback.
Yeah, he is a gambler. Now, he gambled less last year, and I know the Rams were pleased with that, but that doesn't by any means make him a conservative cornerback. I understand why they signed Jenkins, because in theory, if your pass rush is getting home, if that's how you're built, then you want one of those off-coverage corners who jumps passing lanes.
Yeah.
Because the ball is going to come out more predictably, more on time than you would expect, or quicker than you'd expect, but corners can really get a beat on that. So Jenkins fits that. Now, my concern, these guys cost money, and Jenkins got $28 million guaranteed. Prince Amukamara, who signed with the Jaguars, got $3 million guaranteed. Jenkins is not $25 million better than Prince Amukamara was. In fact, Amukamara had almost a comparable season to Jenkins last year playing in that Giants scheme. So I think that I agree. I think the Giants overspent for Jenkins. I understand the logic behind it. If you're going to overspend for Olivier Vernon and try to amplify your pass rush, I understand getting a corner like Jenkins, but it's a lot of money they threw at him.
I just like it. To me, it's almost brash signing him, and it's just the utmost confidence in what their pass rush is going to do this year. And you know, if it doesn't work out, it's gonna blow up in their faces in a lot of ways. So Jenkins, he had some stuff at Florida. He had he was dismissed from the team for drugs, if I remember correctly, Andy. He stayed clean since that. He obviously, you know, he hasn't been a problem in the NFL. It's such a huge gamble by the Giants, and to me, it's just the kind of thing where they're just going all in, that this pass rush is going to be dominant and consistently create the kind of pressure you need to get in order for Janoris Jenkins to be a, you know, the kind of cornerback who gets and justifies $28 million guaranteed.
Yeah. Well, at least there's a plan, and they have a similar type of corner, by the way, in Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie. So I think your point about them going all in on the pass rush, that is a valid one. And the other thing they did, they signed Damon Harrison to play nose tackle next to Jonathan Hankins, and also Jay Bromley hasn't been bad when he's gotten the opportunities. That's a pretty good run defending front. So I think they feel they can create third and long situations. And Spagnuolo, Steve Spagnuolo, their coordinator, has always been very good in third down and long.
Wish you could catch every Major League Baseball game? Now you can. Only T-Mobile customers get a free year-long MLB.TV premium subscription, a $110 value for free, so they'll never miss a game. Hurry and sign up by April 10th to catch any out-of-market game all season long. That's 2,430 games and over 7,000 hours of baseball that will never touch your data plan this season. Thanks to Binge On, only from T-Mobile, you can stream your favorite team's games without using any of your data, because T-Mobile has you covered, unlike those other guys. So get your free MLB.TV premium subscription by April 10th and catch every moment all season long. Switch to the Uncarrier today. Already a T-Mobile customer? Sign up at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Sign up for MLB.TV while on T-Mobile's network. New MLB.TV premium subscribers only. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details. Binge On available to T-Mobile customers with qualifying plan. Detectable video typically streams at DVD quality. Video from participating services doesn't count against full speed data on our U.S. network. Third-party subscription charges may apply. And we're going to go back over the Hudson here to New York, and then we're going to drive way north and way west to New York's only professional football team, Buffalo Bills. Tyrod Taylor told the Daily Press in Virginia he wants to be the long-term solution at quarterback for the Bills. Now, obviously, that's a very noble thing to say, and I'm sure it is what he wants. I had worked with Jenny Vrentis on the Tyrod Taylor piece that she did last, I want to say it was November. Two things struck me about Taylor is one, he seems to have won over the locker room. Even reading between the lines of what guys were saying about him, it seems like his teammates, his coaches, he has the utmost trust of everyone up in Western New York. Now, I just don't know what to think of him as a passer. And part of that is because they have Sammy Watkins, and they just don't have much else as far as target goes. And Chris Hogan is gone now. Charles Clay, I don't know. I just don't think Charles Clay is keeping anyone up at night. I don't know what they can do across from Watkins to sort of develop that number two target and take some of the pressure off of him. But as far as Taylor goes, I just didn't see... He throws a nice deep ball, but I didn't see a whole lot from him as far as being able to function as a pocket passer. I don't know if you saw the same kind of thing from him.
I think we have similar views of Taylor. He does throw a very nice deep ball, and he's effective on the move, which is good because he's mobile, and that's going to be his strength. You can tell by some of their play structures there that Greg Roman came up with in Buffalo, they have simplified things for Taylor. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean he can't be a cerebral quarterback, but his inexperience showed at times last season for the Bills. And nuanced movement in the pocket is so critical, and pocket poise. And that doesn't mean just standing there and, hey, I'm going to throw and I'm going to get hit. That's okay. It means buying time, extending plays naturally within the design of the play by sidestepping pass rushers or subtle nuanced movement in there. And that's something he doesn't have to his game quite yet. So that's maybe that gets developed. That's hard to develop at the NFL level, especially if you've been a run around guy your whole life. The other thing that is a little bit concerning with Taylor is he's more of a see it thrower than an anticipation thrower.
Yes.
So he has to see the receiver break open in order to uncork the ball. And why that's a problem, if you've got arm strength, that's not the worst thing. Like Aaron Rodgers is kind of that way. Tom Brady's actually kind of that way. But if you don't have a big arm like those guys have, then the anticipation becomes more critical to you. So I think Taylor needs to develop just a greater, keener sense of what he's looking at and become more of an anticipation passer in order to make things work there.
So you think
that's why they haven't given him the contract too. I mean, look at the discussion we're having, Gary. There's a lot of questions right now about the guy, and if they felt that he was something different than what we're talking about, they'd probably, and I know they're limited in cap space there in Buffalo, but they'd probably try to find a way to get him locked up for several years.
You think Brady's kind of a see it guy, huh?
Yeah, that's just his style. I'm sure Brady can anticipate as well. And part of that also, to be fair to Brady, they do a lot of option routes in New England. And on option routes, you have to see it because the receiver has to decide what route he's running first.
Yeah. Good point. It sounded like blasphemy, sort of mixed into the Tyrod Taylor take right there. Going out west, Ronnie Hillman, unsigned, smoke around him probably returning to Denver, which means after all that shuffling in the backfield there, it's going to be C.J. Anderson and Ronnie Hillman again. Hillman is really he's weird to me. I mean, when he's 100%, when he's fresh, I think he's better than C.J. Anderson. I think he's a starting caliber back. Last year, he fell off he just went off a cliff, whereas C.J. Anderson was the complete opposite. Anderson really, I guess he had some injuries slowing him down early in the year, and he really came on late in the year. What do you make of this backfield, especially Hillman, under the assumption that he probably is going to return to Denver?
I can't get a feel on Ronnie Hillman. I've been watching him since his rookie season in 2012, and he didn't really start carrying the ball a whole lot till 2014. And at times he looks as good as anybody. You think, oh, lightning quickness, you know, this guy's going to change the dimension of the offense. And other times he's not playing for them. And I haven't been able to decipher the pattern yet on which is which. Is it a good week for Hillman or is it a bad week for Hillman? So I don't know. And it's almost always an indication that there are other things going on behind the scenes. I don't know what those would be with him, but the fact that he's also still unsigned and he's been this mercurial for 4 years now, that's called a red flag.
No, it's wild. I mean, you see him some games and it looks like he's almost intentionally just running into the backs of his linemen and just, you know, taking 0 yard gains, 1 yard loss, 2 yard loss. And it's wild. It's really tough to figure out because again, you know, when he's going good, he is, I don't want to say great. I don't want to oversell it, but he is a very, very good back.
Right. Now, I think for the purposes of Denver, and so you said he's probably better than C.J. Anderson. He's probably more talented.
I should say that early last year, like first half of last season. And also when Hillman started, he had some spot starts, midseason 2014, I thought he was better than C.J. Anderson. By the end of last year, I did not think that.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because he actually had 117 yards rushing in week 17. His week 11 was his other 100-yard game prior to that. He had four 100-yard games on the season. So he'd have 102 yards in week 11, 117 in week 17, but between there, nothing over six. In fact, everything was under 60. So inconsistent. But I think if we're talking a system like Gary Kubiak's, inconsistency is a big problem if you're a running back, because so much of the running lanes are determined by the principles of the blocking. And that's true for every run play. I understand that. But those zone running schemes that we hear about and the continuity along the offensive line and how many factors go into running the ball there, the coach is going to want a running back who he knows what he's getting from him at least.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if you start dancing and leaving holes on the field in an outside zone running scheme like Kubiak likes, you're not going to play very much because it defeats the purpose of you being on the field. It's not a scheme meant for a running back to try to outquick somebody and create. It's a scheme meant for a running back to locate the crease and hit the hole.
Yeah. I mean, I hope they do bring him back. I think he's good. It's just, it's going to be an interesting situation in Denver's backfield again, and not just the quarterback. We'll go a little lightning round here with some of the guys who signed in the past couple of days. Two guys we discussed last week, both landing with Oakland. Reggie Nelson, I think a favorite of both of ours and probably pretty much everyone across the league among the remaining free agents, going to Oakland, solidifying the back end of that secondary. And all of a sudden, they have a pretty deep group of defensive backs, a lot of guys who can cover, something that Oakland did not have the past couple of seasons. I mean, I assume, since we're only 7 days later, that you still like the Reggie Nelson addition to Oakland?
Well, I do when you consider that it's Larry Asante and Tevin McDonald. Tevin, not Devin, not Kevin, but his mm-hmm. name's Tevin McDonald. Who was an undrafted rookie last season out of Eastern Washington. You know, those are the projected starters prior to the Nelson acquisition. So, yeah, I do like the Nelson signing.
Even with those Tevin McDonald bloodlines, Tim McDonald, TJ McDonald.
You know, he might be a nice player. I mean, I haven't watched him, I guess. I guess I can't take shots at the guy if I haven't watched him much. He was practice squad a lot last year. But my point is, they don't have, and they played TJ Carey at safety, and he's actually not bad in that role. Nate Allen's been saying, I mean, they've been searching for answers at the position. And remember what we talked about with Nelson last year is, or last week rather, whenever he gets signed, he'll be a solid, solidifying starter for someone. He's not going to get in there and compete for a job. He's someone you bring in if you want to just say, enough, I'm sick of dealing with the stuff of this position. Just give me a guy and let's know where he's going to be so we can play.
Yep. And I like the fact that they can just play TJ Carey at cornerback.
Yeah, I do too. I like TJ Carey. I think he's one of the best guys in the league to talk football with. So maybe it's personal thing, but I liked his game as a seventh round rookie in 2014. He was a little up and down last year, but he was asked to do a lot of different things as well. They've got some options here because they have Sean Smith at corner, DJ Hayden, who this is a big year for DJ Hayden's career as far as what he's going to be. And then they have David Amerson, who they signed from Washington last year, and he actually wound up becoming their starter and playing very well for them.
That's wild. I mean, I am not an Amerson guy, but
I'm not either. But he was good. He was good for them last year.
He did. He changed my opinion last year. I did not think he could play before last season. I did not understand why the Raiders were trotting him out. And then it was kind of like, oh, he's doing pretty well. He can play a little bit.
And the fact that they trotted him out also speaks very poorly for Keith McGill, their fourth round pick in 2014, and Nico Thorpe, another guy that they acquired in 2014. He's actually from the Chiefs in 2012, was his rookie year. But those are long-armed, talented players who look like they should be on the field. And for the Raiders to go sign David Amerson mid-season in the heat of the battle and then improve when they put him in the starting lineup, that tells you a lot about those other guys too.
Yep.
Which is probably why they signed Sean Smith now too. They need answers at cornerback.
That's good. Raiders fans got to be getting giddy. It's been a good offseason.
Raiders fans get giddy this time every year, though, don't they?
I don't know.
From now until about September 15th, it's the Raiders year. Don't say anything bad about the Raiders. They're going to show you different now. And maybe they will. I think you and I both think they're very talented. But I've gotten so much hate mail from Raiders fans over the years. If you don't say that their team's the greatest heading into a season,
really?
If you acknowledge the losing records, you're subject to the wrath of the black hole.
I never got that sense, but I certainly believe you, Andy.
Yeah, Raiders fans, you want to know who the second most acerbic fan base is? If you get them mad, which you know I'm about to do here, and it's not the Eagles. You'd guess it's the Eagles. It's not them. Their fans are pretty smart.
I mean, we hear from Patriots fans the most, or second most we hear from people who hate the Patriots.
It's mine's in that second category. I think Jets fans are the toughest to deal with after Raider fans.
Really? They seem so I mean, I'm obviously I live in Connecticut. I work in New York. They seem so pessimistic all the time.
Well, yeah, that's true, and that'd be interesting. I don't know. I just think I've gotten the most complaints or like just unwarranted, you call it again, hate mail. It's not hate mail. It's not that kind of strong, but
yeah,
you know what? I've been trolled by Jets fans as much as more than any team other than Raiders fans over the years. And I've always said nice things about both teams for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Have you ever asked yourself why razors are one of the only products in the drugstore that are locked inside a plexiglass case? It's because good razors cost too much, so much that people are more likely to steal them than just about any other product in the drugstore. That's why two guys started Harrys.com. They sell high-quality blades that provide a close, comfortable shade for half the price you're used to. Harrys gives you factory-direct prices. They cut out the middleman and ship their products right to your door. Stop getting ripped off. Harry's starter set is the best option for new customers, and it's a great deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, foaming shave gel, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, for listeners of this show, Harry's is giving you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code THEMMQB. Go to harrys.com right now. That's HARRYS.com. And make sure you use the code THEMMQB at checkout to let them know who sent you. We'll move on since this was the lightning round and we just spent 14 minutes on Reggie Nelson. Alden Smith, the other guy, coming back to Oakland, basically, you know, no guarantees in that deal. It's going to be sort of pay as you go as far as what they get from him. Obviously, you know, we both agreed last week he's a better signing than Greg Hardy, which I guess really isn't saying much at this point.
No.
And he can play. He can play if he can get his life together, which hopefully he does.
Yeah, he's a real difference maker, and you root for him, and I think the people that know him are rooting for him. And it's interesting because when you have a guy like Alden Smith, and he's had so many off-field issues and they're personal demons that are driving the issues, sometimes it's good to put him in a new area, you know, put him on the East Coast where he doesn't have the same network of people around him. But it was almost a consensus that those who knew him thought he needs to stay in the Bay Area and keep working on the stuff he's trying to help himself with. And so it's good that he's able to re-sign in Oakland if that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Jared Crick going to Denver, 2 years, $4 million. Obviously, he's not going to replace Malik Jackson. I mean, he will in the most literal sense. Perhaps I assume they have him playing inside for the most part there. I don't know. I mean,
He'll probably be a D tackle in nickel if he's on the field in nickel. I know you feel he's kind of just a guy, and his contract says he's just a guy.
I like him.
There's been a lot of times though he's looked. He flashes on film. He's not an explosive player, but he'll flash more than a guy of his skill set typically flashes.
Yeah. Yeah. Vernon Davis to Washington. I have sad thoughts about Vernon Davis, but I'll let you go first on that.
Well, I know Washington would like to have – they feel that Jordan Reed is by far their most important player on offense, probably next to the quarterback just because it's quarterback. So if that's the case, my guess is the more they can be flexible around Jordan Reed, the better, and that means having a second receiving tight end. They've got Logan Paulson and Niles Paul, both blocking-type tight ends. To have another receiving tight end – gives them a dimension that I think that Sean McVay, their coordinator, and Jay Gruden would really like. So it's a risk with Davis, but if he doesn't work out, you didn't lose anything to get him if you're Washington. You've got the same team you have last year, and that team got a lot better over the course of the season. But almost everything they do on offense anymore is going to be tied to amplifying Jordan Reed because he's such a good dynamic player for them.
Yeah. Vernon Davis, when I watch him, I feel like he has – vision problems. And I don't mean to laugh at that or joke about it. I just feel like he just misjudges passes that are kind of like, huh? I'm not sure what's going on with him. He was never, he was never the greatest ball skills guy, but something weird is going on with him. I don't know.
Well, from what I've been told with people around Vernon Davis who would know this kind of thing, is that he's not someone you can give two things to do at once to. In other words, you can't give him an option route. You don't want him processing too much on the fly. He's more of an athlete than a thinking man's football player. And that doesn't mean he's stupid. I'm not saying that at all. It's just the style of play that certain guys have. And Tony Gonzalez was the same way, by the way. He was just a get out there and let's play. Don't ask me to explain what I'm seeing because I'm being an athlete out there. And he's one of the most – Gonzalez is one of the most accomplished, decorated tight ends, in fact, the most in the NFL. So you can function like that. And Davis runs well. But you've got to – that's why I didn't think he had any chance at all of succeeding in Denver, because you can't bring him in midstream and then teach him a new offense that has a lot of variables to it. That's just not his game. He's an athlete out there, and you need to use him that way.
Hey, he's a terp. I'm rooting for him. But he worries me with some of the drops he had. Last guy here.
Well, and I don't know about the vision thing you said, Gary, but doesn't it seem like if you're not comfortable with what you're doing out there, you'd be more prone to drops?
Yeah, I've been spilling tea all over myself throughout this podcast because I can't listen to you and drink at the same time.
That's the opposite of what anyone who's ever really known me well has said about listening to me and having to drink.
I got to get a straw or something. I don't know. Last guy is Terrence Knighton to the Patriots. Pot roast. He can play. I mean, this seems like sort of a very, you know, it's a 1 year, $2.018 million deal. Seems like a no lose proposition as far as the Patriots are concerned. And obviously he gets to play for a Super Bowl title.
And he's going to get 1/3 of the snaps a game because he's just not a nickel player. But on those 1/3 that he gets, he has a chance on every snap to be the most dominant guy on the field. He's another guy who really flashes, and he's easily the biggest defensive lineman in the NFL, and yet he's got light feet. Now, we all know the issues anytime a guy is nicknamed Pot Roast and he gets one-year contracts every year with weight clauses in them this time. We know what the risks are with him. But like you said, there's not a lot of downside because Malcolm Brown's going to be the guy there. They still have Alan Branch. Even Joe Villano played a few years ago. Ishmael Kitchen there, who probably won't make the final roster. I liked him in Cleveland at times. It's a very good, staunch interior defensive line rotation now for New England.
I mean, there's nothing not to like there. That was a very nice addition for New England. Changing gears a little bit. Andy, they are going to stream games on Twitter. Is this going to change your life? You're going to start watching games on your phone?
Here's how I watch games now. I set my DVR, and then I go exercise or do chores or whatever, or read, and then I start the game about 2 hours later, and I watch on DVR where I don't care about looking at Twitter. I'm not going to watch as many commercials and stoppages as the NFL demands that you watch if you see these games live. And there's not a thing in the world that will make me change my habits now. If I have to watch something live on Twitter, I'm not going to do it, because the NFL games have just far, far too many stoppages of play for a variety of reasons now. It's maddening.
So let me ask you something. When you watch a game DVR style, obviously you're fast forwarding through the commercials, which is, again, it's anti-capitalist, it seems like to me, but that's all right. do you fast forward between plays?
No, never. Absolutely not. Because I might, if it's like a 30-point blowout and I'm going to turn the game off anyway. Even then, I tend to turn those off because I think you get a false picture of teams when you watch meaningless snaps. But no, I don't fast forward in between plays because I do like the presentation of the broadcast when they're actually broadcasting it. And it's too important to see the formations and replays anyway that you can't afford to fast forward plays if you're taking notes during the game.
I have two brothers who, and we do the same thing. We'll wait, you know, an hour, hour and a half before the game's, or after the game has started, before we start watching it. They will fast forward between plays, and it is overwhelming. I end up like curled up in a fetal position because it's too much football to take in. It's like everyone's running some sort of hyper up-tempo offense, and it's an absurd way to watch a football game.
Right. I don't understand what you'd get out of that unless you're just a super casual fan, which some people are. I get that. You know, this time of year, I watch NBA games, and when the playoffs start, I'll watch them. I love NBA playoffs because it's like the only time of year where I don't really have to do football stuff in the evenings.
Yeah.
And so I watch the NBA playoffs. I will fast forward free throws in the first half of a lot of those games and just watch to see if they made it or not in the score ticker.
Okay.
So I get the idea of fast forwarding. But for football, if you want to learn something, and not everybody does, but if you want to learn something, you can't fast forward from play to play.
No, it's wild. It really is. It's overwhelming. My brain needs a break. I need to, you know, sort of rest and be able to reset myself for the next play. But that's, you know, that's it. They're going to have Twitter on, or excuse me, they're going to have football on Twitter.
Are you going to do this Twitter during a game? Do you look at Twitter during games? See, I couldn't care less what people tweet during games, because everybody's going to tweet something at some point.
I only look at Twitter if I think I've spotted something weird, or I think I've caught a blown call or something like that, as a sort of, am I crazy or did Vince Wilfork just play that down without pants? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
As far as, like, you know, constantly having the second screen, it's just not for me. Too old. I'm 84 years old. It's too much for me.
How old are you really? Would you say that on the air? Because I don't think I quite know.
I'll be 37 in a couple months.
Okay.
Here. Which, again,
yeah, so you would
in social media terms, I'm too old to have a second screen.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's dinosaur there, but that's not too bad. So, and your kids will grow up having never seen commercials, I'm guessing, too, because I have friends with kids about the age of your kids, and they don't know what commercials are. So what this conversation, because they're used to Netflix and streaming and all that stuff. So the conversation we're having now is one that's going to return in the next generation, because at some point football fans are gonna become like me, and just they're not gonna be equipped to watch commercials. They're not gonna have the willingness to do it.
It is. It's a brave new world. I like how football fans are gonna become like me.
Yeah, they'll catch up to me at some point.
Yeah,
they'll catch up to me at some point. It really is. So if you watch every single game that's available on TV, so three games on Sunday, one on Monday, one on Thursday, I watch one in each window. So that's five games a week just on TV. If you're eliminating commercials and starting those at your own convenience, you save about probably 10 hours in your week. If you free up 10 hours to do something else.
No,
it sounds ridiculous. It's been life-changing for me, though, going to Twitter, or excuse me, going to DVR on football games.
That's legit. I mean, the whole problem for me is, you know, if Peter's – I edit you and I edit Peter on Sunday nights, and I have to be caught up on everything. I can't tell Peter, you know, don't write about Broncos Patriots, because or at least don't tell me how it ends.
Right.
Because I still got to watch the game
too.
Tomorrow.
I say I'll call you after I'm done watching, because I know he'll be up late, fortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
My biggest fear this year was that I'd get a spoiler from Peter during the season, because we call and talk on Sunday nights so that we don't write the same things. And I didn't. I got one spoiler all year, but it was a blowout. Raiders blew out the Chargers, and Moravik, the editor, our head editor, and Peter both contacted me and said, you got to find something else to write about, because I was going to write about the San Diego's striving forward or something like that.
Yeah, I think we had something Philip Rivers queued up.
That's what it was. Yeah, it was Philip Rivers' big passing numbers, and then he had like a horrible passing day for his first one of the year or something.
Yep.
Yeah, but one out of 17 weeks for spoilers, that's not bad for a guy that watches everything on DVR. Would you agree?
It's not. No, that's fantastic. Again, brave new world. One more deep dive here. John Schneider in the Seattle Times here made the point that the Seahawks essentially have not made a conscious decision to ignore the offensive line. It's just the way it's worked out. I'm paraphrasing here. He didn't really say these words. But essentially, they've invested in defense. They're a defense-first team. Now, Russell Okung is gone. They had that sort of new look post-Marshawn offense last year that they sort of rolled out in the second half of the season, the Pittsburgh game, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
A lot more spread, even post Jimmy Graham. They were putting up numbers. Russell Wilson, obviously, is a guy who can move around. Is it going to work with what is I mean, it has to be the worst offensive line in football right now. I would assume they would draft one or two linemen early, but, you know, plugging two rookies in there, I don't know if that's going to be enough. As a matter of fact, I would say it will certainly not be enough. Can they function? Can they do what they did last year with this group?
Well, I'm glad you said it was the Pittsburgh game, by the way, because a lot of people think that Seattle's explosion took place the week before against San Francisco because they had big numbers in that game, too. But they became a different offense in that Pittsburgh game. The Niners game was a function of other things, a lot of random plays. But in the Pittsburgh game moving forward, this became one of the best drop-back passing offenses in the NFL last year. And that, to me, was the biggest, most shocking news of the NFL season, of all the season of 2015, because I didn't think Russell Wilson could play that way, and he had never played that way before. So now I was eager when I went to the combine this year to ask people in the Seahawks organization, what in the hell happened? How did that go? How did that work that way? And I did get a chance, and the answer I got was that the offensive line shored up in critical ways moving forward in week 12. They mm-hmm. got better in the offensive line. And one of the things they did was put Patrick Lewis at center, and the other thing, they felt that Gary Gilliam at right tackle got better. So the reason I share this is because people like me have said over the years offensive line's a little bit overrated for Seattle because Wilson plays such randomized football and mm-hmm. they move the pocket anyway. And if you move the pocket, you almost never get sacked. So you don't need great linemen to play with a guy like Wilson stylistically. But Russell Wilson also overcame his glass ceiling last season. And if you have that kind of Russell Wilson, you're going to be a Super Bowl contender every year. So I feel different. I think they do need a good O-line here. And it surprises me because of that as John Schneider said, they've just overlooked the offensive line or whatever it is this season. They can't go into week one with Bradley Sole at left tackle, though. I know that.
Yeah. No, looking at the names on the depth chart here, Mark Lewinsky, he's a guy I remember from West Virginia. I always thought when I watched him at West Virginia, I said, yeah, that guy's going to be a starter. He's going to be someone starting right guard for 8 years. The other guy, you know, Terry Poole was a fourth rounder last year. Always seemed like more of a swing tackle type guy, at least coming out of San Diego State. My personal favorite is Christian Sokoli, who is both Albanian and a University of Buffalo grad, which is a very exciting combination. And on top of that, he played defensive line at Buffalo, which is obviously why he appeals to Tom Cable so greatly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you patch this together. And you're presumably not going to get... I mean, you're not going to get a plug-and-play left tackle with the wherever they're picking, 28th. I should have that in front of me, but I don't. It just seems like this is a this is going to be a hurting unit. I mean, Russell Wilson is going to take a pounding.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned, because all those guys you just listed, they were rookies last year, fifth 2015 rookies, fourth or sixth round picks, all of them. So I don't know anything about them because they didn't play meaningful snaps. Mm-hmm. But Tom Cable knows about them, and Pete Carroll knows about them. And Daryl Bevel, offensive coordinator, knows about them. So maybe they feel more comfortable with their young depth than we realize. Maybe they think those guys are good. The other thing to consider, they played Justin Britt as a rookie out of the gates, not at the position he's at now, not at left guard. I believe he's at right tackle early in his career.
Right.
But I don't think they're totally averse to playing rookies in that scheme either. I think they are comfortable putting young guys out on the field. So you know, sometimes in the offseason, we all panic about something. We look at one position group that just looks bad on paper. But in reality, it's just that we don't know anything about the position group. And that doesn't mean they're good or bad. It means that they're unknown.
It's, boy, it's just...
Devil's advocate. I'm sure they didn't wake up at the beginning of free agency and say, hey, let's make sure we come out of this thing with Bradley Sole as our left tackle Lewinsky as our starting right guard. I mean, I'm sure that's not the exact intention, but you know what I'm saying? Maybe they don't feel the urgency we do because they like their guys more than we realize.
Yeah, yeah. I had one more aside on this Seattle story, and this is going to be a terrible joke, but I'm gonna say it anyway. So I was, you know, I was looking at this Seattle Times article and pulling the Schneider quotes off of that, and I saw on the side one of the related headlines or top stories headlines were Garfield teacher fired over field trip allegations, fights for her job. And all I could think was, Garfield teacher, that's a it's an awfully thin curriculum. I mean, really, all you have to know is likes lasagna and hates Mondays.
Okay, very good, Gary.
You like that?
We have a Garfield school here in Boise. My father went to it. He would not take kindly to what you just said right there.
Oh, do you guys have James A. Garfield love as well? No, that's I'm actually skimming the story now to make sure I didn't just make light of a horrible situation. Unpleasant situation. She seems like a nice lady. It looks like there was an incident between a male and female student on her field trip and cost her job. That's a bummer. But yeah, I don't know. I saw that and laughed because I am lame. Baseball is back. The crack of the bat, freshly mowed grass, hot dogs, beer, afternoon at Citi Field, and of course, daily fantasy baseball. If you're not playing FanDuel this season, you're missing out on the most fun a baseball fan can have. On FanDuel, you choose. Do I compete to win cash from fans around the world or start a listener league with my friends? Either way, you get to be the GM. Study the matchups, get your money ball on, and set your winning lineup. Entry fees start at just $1, and there's no season-long commitment. Play for one day or 180 days plus playoffs. And here's the best part. FanDuel is giving new players their first game risk-free. Here's what you do. Just go to FanDuel.com and enter the code THEMMQB. Then enter a FanDuel league or start one with one of your friends. If you don't win any prize in your first contest, you get that $10 right back to your FanDuel account for more play. That's FanDuel.com with the code THEMMQB for a risk-free tournament at up to $10. We're going to do a quick wrap, and I'm going to make you do something that you don't like doing.
Yeah, it's fantasy dork. I already know what's coming.
Fantasy football questions.
Last week we did fantasy dork, and we actually I went back and listened to the show. We never actually addressed any fantasy elements of it. I just wound up talking about the player in general.
Well, it's good. Well, no, you want to know if the players are good or not is basically what it comes down to. I mean,
well,
yeah,
I think
we're not
fantasy people want to know if they'll put up numbers because
but
usually good players put up numbers, but not always are the guys that put up numbers good players.
We're not looking for statistical projections quite yet in March. I just want to know what you think of these guys, and I will file it away in my fantasy dorkdom, filing cabinet, I guess.
Yep.
Sticking in Seattle, Doug Baldwin, that late season surge, what was that, and will it happen again?
Well, it was part of the pocket passing emphasis that was improved in there in Seattle. They also, along with the pocket passing, they went to more 3-by-1 sets, which is three receivers to one side, one receiver to the other side. Often that one receiver was a tight end, so it was actually a closed formation. There was nobody detached out there wide. It was just three receivers on one side of the field. Mm-hmm. And why that's important is because that dictates matchups a lot of the times, and inside receivers are going to get more matchups out of that formation. They're going to get more matchups against linebackers or safeties. And Doug Baldwin is Seattle's most prominent inside receiver. So he fits what they do. They do a good job of scheming ways to get him open. I think he has improved gradually every year of his career. And so if we're looking at a fantasy dork angle on it, I would bet, I don't know, you know, Doug Baldwin probably has, 1,000 yards or so over the last few seasons, each of them. I would bet he'd be right around that mark, plus maybe an extra 100 this year as he continues to expand his game.
All right. Steven Ridley to Detroit, I assume takes over the, or at least assuming he is healthy, takes over the Joik Bell sort of big back role in that tandem. I always am interested in guys in that first, or I should say second full year off of the torn ACL. It seems like just a rule of thumb is guys are more comfortable in that second year back. If they're going to be 100% again, second year is when they'll show it. What did you see from Ridley last year, and what do you see from that sort of shaky Detroit front five in general?
Well, Ridley is hard to gauge because he wasn't all the way back last season, as you kind of intimated there. When he was good, and that, you know, when he was good in 2012, he was really good, and he could get skinny through small holes. He had an excellent understanding of how to set up his blocks between the tackles. Now, the more I think about Stephen Ridley, that was 2012, all right? He had 12 touchdowns that year, mm-hmm. 1,263 yards rushing. He had barely over 1,000 yards combined over the next two seasons after that, in part because of injuries. He only started 11 games. He played in 20. And then last season, he was coming off the knee injury, and he played with the Jets and started one game and had 36 rushing attempts. And that's why I don't know much about him from last year, because he wasn't touching the ball. So Bob Quinn had him in New England. Bob Quinn's now Detroit's general manager, so he must like him personally. He must feel confident about Stephen Ridley as an all-encompassing football player, locker room, film room guy, pass protection guy, whatever. Mm-hmm. As far as a runner goes, though, Gary, I think we're talking about a guy, really, Stephen Ridley has played five NFL seasons, and he's been productive in one of them.
Yeah.
He fumbles. Which is too bad, because I like him. I really liked his game.
He fumbles.
There's no evidence that says he can play still.
He and Amir Abdullah are going to, I don't know. Detroit's going to lose like 8 fumbles a game.
Well, yeah, because Abdullah did have issues with that. You know, the guy that nobody talks about in Detroit, and I think he's their best backfield player. In fact, I thought last season, including Calvin Johnson, because of the way they used him, I thought he was their most dangerous weapon a lot of the time.
Theo Riddick.
Yeah. Their other running back. Nobody talks about him. He's what Reggie Bush was supposed to be for the Lions when Bush became a Lion. Not Bush with the Saints early on when Bush was at his best. But he's Reggie, and he's quicker than Reggie Bush ever was as well. He is really hard to match up against. I think he's your most important player in the backfield.
Yeah. No, he's good. Last guy, Carlos Hyde, supposedly slimmed down. Is he Chip Kelly's bell cow? And I don't know. DeMarco Murray obviously fell flat on his face last year in Chip Kelly's system. Is Carlos Hyde gonna, I guess, fall victim to the same type of deal? I mean, Hyde played in sort of a spread, a lot of read option stuff in at Ohio State. And obviously they had some elements of that with Kaepernick there in San Francisco. Does he fit better with what Chip Kelly's going to try and do?
Yeah, he does. Hyde is a significantly better player than DeMarco Murray. He's a better runner. He's more decisive. He can change directions and confined areas a little bit. It's good that he lost weight. I thought he had decent power to him, but he's probably wanting to be more durable over 16 weeks and not wanting to carry extra weight. I think he'll fit just fine. Keep in mind, Chip Kelly's system produced the most rushing yards in the NFL, I believe, his first year in the league, and was right up around there again his second year in the league.
Yep.
And people don't think about that with Chip Kelly either. He's more of a running coach than a passing coach. He'll throw it a lot, and he got away from the run game at times last year, and that was a little perplexing, but his run game also wasn't very talented, and didn't have the right personnel for what he's doing. Yeah. If he's got the right personnel, he'll be fine. Now, the concern is that their right guard's Andrew Tiller, and their center is Daniel Kilgore. Their left guard is Ian Silberman. That's not good enough. You need a lot more athleticism in the middle of the O-line for Kelly's scheme, because they do so many sweeps to the edges.
So maybe give it a year.
I might give it a year. But Carlos Hyde is just an entity, a ball-running entity. I think he's a very good player. I liked him a lot last season.
Good, good. No, we in the fantasy dork world appreciate your input, Andy.
Oh, yeah, I got to give numbers, don't I? Because we're doing fantasy. Otherwise, it's
give me some numbers.
Here. Well, all right, Carlos Hyde, what did he finish with last
year?
Well,
he was hurt.
I know he was hurt, so his numbers were skewed. Carlos Hyde had 470 yards rushing, 4.1 average on 7 games, 7 starts. So along those lines, I think he'd be about if he stays healthy, which is, you can say that of any guy, I think he's about a 1,000 yard back.
Okay. Not bad. Not bad. We'll take
that. Not bad. I think he's got the talent to be a 12 or 1300 yard back too, but he's been in the NFL 2 years now, and he's only started 7 games. Wasn't his fault as a rookie. You know, he didn't play a whole lot.
He was behind Frank Gore.
But it's you know, we need to see it a little bit first before we expect the breakout from him. But he's the talents there.
All right. All right. Well, we appreciate it, Andy. I think that's going to be it. That's it for our second show. How do you think it went?
I enjoyed it. This was good. We didn't talk about Johnny Manziel, which is nice. We didn't last week, but we
that was actually outside
we could
of
have
golf.
This week we could outside have been, of, we didn't, and I think that's a real testament to our character.
Outside of golf, that's the only thing. That's the only football I saw on TV today. Was the story that Gary Kubiak spoke words in the general direction of Johnny Manziel, and therefore Johnny Manziel will be penciled in as the Broncos starter in week one. But yeah, we can.
Team named the Broncos, that might be true. But that's about the only way I could see that happening.
Well, I think maybe Manziel covers like a, I don't know, 6 podcast series that we'll do later in the off season or something like that.
Yeah, and sadly, those will get better numbers in these podcasts too.
Oh, that'll do it. He is Andy Benoit. I am Gary Gramling. This has been the MMQB podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.